The odds are good that you know a narcissist. The odds are also good that they are intelligent, confident, and articulate, the center of attention. Narcissists are everywhere. There are millions of them in the United States alone. Entertainers, politicians, business people, your neighbors. Recognizing and understanding them is crucial to your not being overtaken by them, according to Jeffrey Kluger in his new book, The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. Kluger explores the new research on narcissism and explains the complex, exasperating personality disorder. Jeffrey Kluger is a senior editor and writer at Time magazine. He is co-author of the bestseller Apollo 13 and the author of The Sibling Effect, Simplexity, Splendid Solution, and Moon Hunters. It's always a great pleasure to have him on the program and welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Always nice to have you on the program. So how did you come to this particular subject, this disorder?
Well, there are a few things. First of all, as with my book, The Sibling Effect, I noticed that there was research percolating up in the journals as long ago as 2007. There was a fair bit of this, a fair bit of research coming up that hadn't been done before. I also, to be perfectly honest, felt like I had something of a stake in it because it's, you know, I have never been even close to a clinical narcissist, but I've struggled with issues of an inflated sense of entitlement and, you know, too much of a hunger for the spotlight and too much of a sense of outrage if I didn't get it in my life. You know, I like to tell the story about when I wrote my first book, you cite Apollo 13, and I collaborated with the astronaut, Jim Lovell, American hero who remains a dear friend. And as soon as he said, yes, let's collaborate on this book, the first thing that insinuated itself was my thinking, well, gee, whose name should go first on the byline? After all, I'm the journalist. My name is alphabetically first. Then I thought back to 1970 and realized Jim Lovell went to the moon that year. I went to summer camp. So it's a little bit different, and Jim's name went first.
So you bring up a good point, which is, and it's a good place to start, which is, do all of us have narcissistic tendencies, which is different than being diagnosed in a clinical sense as a narcissist?
The answer to that is emphatically yes. Narcissistic personality disorder, in its clinical truly dysfunctional sense, affects only from 1 to 3% of the population, and it's those people who can be really disabled and undone by it. As you move down the spectrum, you see varying degrees of narcissism. Now, sometimes it's still a pretty nasty temperament, a pretty nasty personality, and people do, even if they're not clinical, they do burn through marriages, they burn through jobs, they burn through relationships and friendships because they just exhaust and exasperate the people around them. You know, that sense of entitlement, that lack of empathy, that sense of grandiosity, that resistance, ferocious resistance to criticism, all of these things can get tiresome after a while. But a little further down the spectrum, and it becomes actually a good and even essential thing for success, narcissistic traits can be very bracing for the personality. If you're going to go in for a job interview or you're going to pitch something at a meeting, you've got to have confidence to know that or to believe that, yeah, this is the best idea these people have ever heard. I am the best person for this job. I enjoy being in this situation and can sell the hell out of this thing. Same thing applies if you walk into a singles bar and meet somebody. You may know rationally you're not the best-looking person in the room or you're not the most charismatic person, but you've got to be able to walk in and say, I look pretty hot tonight, and I am confident in my ability to make a good impression and, you know, meet someone here. So we all need that. It's people who don't have enough of that who tend to languish and not do well. So as with so many other things, it's on a spectrum.
You use the term of taking them down and languishing and not doing well, but there is a differentiation here of a narcissist who is successful and a narcissist who is not.
Well, that's right. And the other thing about unsuccessful narcissists, I'm not talking here about people, you know, when I say languishing, I'm talking about people with self-esteem that's too low or people who are too diffident and don't achieve their full potential because they're uneasy about selling themselves, which is, you know, that's a perfectly legitimate issue that a lot of people wrestle with and they find compensations for it. But when narcissists crash and burn, or as somebody I interviewed said, they tend to crash and smolder because they never completely go away. It's typically because they've overreached. It's typically because they've worn people out. It's also because the narcissist, say the narcissist on the job, they're very, very good at what's called the emerging phase of a company or a project. When you're in a pitch meeting, when a company is starting up, and there's tons of opportunity for meetings and recognition and applause for what you're doing and brainstorming, in which everyone notices that you're the one who's come up with these terrific ideas, or doing the press conferences when you launch your new company. The day-to-day work of managing the product, managing the company, hand-holding the account you've just sold, all of these things take a greater kind of patience, a greater kind of deliberateness, and not quite so much a ravenous an appetite for recognition and validation. It's in those phases that narcissists tend not to do well. That's when the CEO of a company is going to crash and burn or crash and smolder. That's when an employee is going to stop producing and will either be reassigned somewhere else or will be fired as a result of just not doing the job anymore. And that's also where people in relationships tend to fall apart. When that seductive, high energy, thrilling first 6 months of being newly in love and being wildly sexual, when all that stops, or at least it quiets down some, and it comes to the day-to-day reciprocal work of building and holding a lasting relationship, that's where narcissists fall apart.
Talking about it in the work sense, you write that one of the worst things about narcissists in the workplace is that their unlovely traits emerge even when things are going well. Profits may be up, products may be thriving, and there may be nothing but praise to go around, and yet the self-promoters are still angling to get more than their share of credit and deny others theirs. So I think that's an important point, because even it's not a sense of okay, this is what happens. I mean, it's bad both times, right? If things are going well, it's still going to rear its head. If things are going poorly, it's going to rear its head.
Well, yeah, if things are going poorly, then you get the blame contagion. The narcissist will absolutely refuse that they had any role at all in a bungled rollout or a bad product or a bad quarter, and will blame the people around them, which only causes those people to blame other people, which is why it's called a blame contagion. The problem with the situation when things are going well is that for narcissism, all applause and rewards are a zero-sum game. So if you and I work together and I'm a narcissist and I've just gotten all kinds of rewards and recognition for something I did, and then it's your turn, instead of saying, hey, this is great, the whole team is doing well, I will think that every dollar or hand clap you get is one subtracted from my total, and therefore it's a bad thing for you to do well. That's why people who look at narcissists in businesses will point out that it's not enough for the narcissist to succeed. It's important that the surrounding people also fail. Otherwise, there's just, you know, all the rewards have to be yours. And if you've built your pedestal as high as it can possibly go and you can't get any higher, then the only thing you can do is force the people around you to stand in a hole in the ground to lower them.
Do you feel that there's an expiration date on narcissism, that at some point it catches up to you?
Well, yeah, that's a good question, and it has a number of answers. First of all, yes, it does tend to catch up with you, and that is when the jobs will be lost and the profit and the companies will fail and the marriages will fall apart. And some narcissists do develop a learning curve, and after enough of that, they do tend to say, I've got to be doing something wrong. You know, you have a big enough, long enough trail of smoldering wreckage behind you, and you have to think, maybe things just aren't working out. Too often, however, narcissism is what's known as an egosyntonic condition. That means you don't just, you know, act as if you're better than everyone else. You really think you are. It's a little bit like paranoia also. The paranoid person doesn't have the illusion that people are, well, it is an illusion, but they think someone is really after them. So people can, you know, they can play this narcissistic game right into the grave and never fully get over it. Now you wind up alone and embittered, and, you know, but even then you're blaming the people around you for it. In some cases, though, with narcissism and all personality disorders, The symptoms can be tempered a little bit with age. Sometimes just getting older will sort of bring the wattage down on your narcissistic symptoms, in the same way that some people, criminals, after a while will just age out of crime. You just don't have the energy anymore to, you know, be a second-story man and climb into windows and steal stuff, so you find another way to make your money.
You likened it to paranoia, but that's a part of it too, right? Paranoia is very much a part of the personality often.
Well, the paranoia is a separate personality disorder. There are 10 personality disorders, and if I tried to rattle them all off, I would surely miss some of them.
You don't need to do that.
No.
I don't want you to upset anyone with it.
No, but they're paranoid, and they're borderline, and they're histrionic, and
yeah.
schizotypal, and all kinds of them. I don't necessarily think paranoia and narcissism overlap, although there's a school of thinking that we should blow up all the definitions on the personality disorder spectrum and just sort of line them all up. To the extent that there is paranoia, I think you would see it in the workplace, in which you wouldn't simply, again, celebrate somebody else's success. You would say, why is he angling to get a piece of my turf, when maybe you're not. You're just, you know, the next guy in the next office, and you're doing a good job, and you're trying to get your piece of the action, too, and it's got nothing to do with me. Narcissists are grandiose enough to say everything is about them. And, in fact, I used to say that as a joke, that, you know, behind all paranoia is grandiosity, because you assume people are thinking about you. Well, grandiosity is a component of narcissism.
Journalist Jeffrey Kluger is our guest. His book is The Narcissist Next Door, Understanding the Monster in Your Family, in Your Office, in Your Bed, in Your World. The book is just out from Riverhead. Let us talk a little bit about how the person gets this way. At what point do we start to see the traits most commonly?
Well, as I say in the book, and I don't mean this entirely flippantly, we see it in the womb. I mean, you know, a fetus is a totally opportunistic parasitic organism. It takes without giving, it consumes without returning, and it damages the person around it. That's what a fetus does. And in fact, people have written about this.
They don't have that on the cards. Congratulations on your new baby. Yeah.
Congratulations on the parasite.
Yes, good for you.
Osteoporotic and hypertense. Yeah, it's not a good thing. But, of course, the fetus, there's no sentience at all in the fetus. And you see this among babies as well. Babies are perfect narcissists. There's a wonderful book out whose name I can't say on the air because it includes some frank language.
Yes.
The title, but, you know, the four terrifically funny mothers called Babies the Animal Kingdom's Most Mean-Spirited Young. Because newborns and toddlers are all about me. They are all about immediate gratification. They're all about my needs to the expense of other people. They take without giving. They demand without thanking. They'll think nothing about clobbering another baby over a head with a set of blocks. But if they get hit in return, they howl in outrage. All of this is pure and perfect weapons-grade narcissism. What happens is, as we get older, and this means, you know, just out of toddlerhood into pre-K and so forth, you begin to get what's called the theory of mind, the idea that what's in my mind is not the same as what's in somebody else's. And people's feelings, people have independent feelings, independent experiences. That's where empathy develops. That's where reciprocity develops. That's where a sense of appreciation that mom went to a whole lot of work to make you this lunch, and the first time, you know, a baby or a toddler says thank you, when they're thank you unbidden and seems to mean it, it's a sweet moment for a parent, because that means you get it. You get that I'm working for you and you appreciate that. But that comes slowly. The healthy person follows that developmental arc all the way through adulthood. You begin to work reciprocally in a world full of people in which everybody helps everyone out, everybody applauds everyone else, everyone understands that we have to be empathic and we're not entitled. Narcissists keep coming up against walls in all of those developmental lanes.
When it comes to because you think of, for many of us, then, as we grow up, life kind of bats you around and takes that out of you, right?
I mean, yeah, well, that is true. And there's something called the Narcissistic Personality Inventory. It's a 40-question survey that's pretty much seen as the standard.
You include it in the book, right?
I include it in the book, yes. And the average American score is between 15 and 16. Now, there's a very narrow range in which you start to have problems. If you get up into the high teens or certainly in the 20s, you've got some serious narcissistic problems. And demographics can make a difference in how you score. People of a certain income may score a little higher. Males tend to score a little bit higher than women do. Highly educated people score a little bit higher. And younger people tend to score higher than older people, too, for the exact reason you're saying. They haven't gotten batted around. They haven't gotten humbled. They haven't gone out for a job and not gotten it and had that happen a couple times and realized, gee, maybe this isn't a sense of entitlement. Maybe this is just a hard world and I'm not always going to succeed. When you're in college, you think, you know, hey, I'm doing great. I'm getting A's. I'm well thought of. Life is going to be a glide path. Then you find out it's not, and you come down to earth a little bit.
We have been talking about this behavior and giving some examples, and of course, because this book is very much for the people who deal with a narcissist, right? I mean,
it's how to
work with it, and it's one thing to work for an individual like this. It's quite another to live with an individual like this.
Yeah, it is. It is. I mean, when you are. When you're in a company, you know, and you work for a narcissist or with a narcissist, the sure way to be done with this is get another job. And now that's not an easy thing to do. But if you get another job, you know, the boss who's been this terrifying, powerful person in your life instantly becomes a figure of irrelevance and powerlessness. It's much harder to walk away from a marriage, and you know, it's all but impossible to walk away from blood relatives. You know, you're just not going to completely write off your narcissistic parent or brother or child, though some people do. There are some ways to manage it. I say quite a bit that, you know, it's not about you. And even though for the narcissist, everything is about the narcissist, you have to realize the narcissist behavior is not about you. Do not personalize the narcissist behavior. It comes from a well of pain. It comes from a well of insecurity. Maybe it comes from a well of legitimate, real grandiosity that's not just a masquerade, which, you know, narcissism can go both ways. But either way, it's all about dysfunction within the person. That's an important thing. Lower your expectations is an important thing. Do not engage in fights about the narcissism. Don't say, but you should do this, but you shouldn't do that. You will never win that fight because the narcissist the condition is called egocentric. They don't get it. They think they are entitled to these things. Therapy can help sometimes, not often. Couples counseling can help if the narcissist really values the marriage a lot and thinks, damn, I'm going to lose this marriage. Sometimes that brings them around. Other times, just age helps. The older narcissists get, the more these symptoms tend to mellow a bit.
I do. We just have a moment or two left, but I do want to highlight one thing that you write about in the book, and that is narcissists in sports, and especially what we're seeing now in the NFL. This is fascinating because there tends to be this habit of a sports star who lives outside the rules, and they often get special treatment, and we're kind of dealing with some of the ramifications of that now, aren't we?
We are, and that's the thing. I mean, when I was talking about mask model of narcissism, the idea that narcissism is a masquerade to cover up self-loathing, that's a real phenomenon. But the other side is people whose lives have just taught them that they're outside the rules. I mean, these are people who were celebrated when they were in high school for being great athletes. They got into colleges on full scholarships. They graduated with diplomas, having often not passed their classes and sometimes not even attended them. And, you know, they get $20 million signing bonuses when they, you know, first day of reporting to work, or maybe not that much, but eight-figure signing bonuses still, the first day they report to work. Well, you know, why shouldn't they think they're outside the rules? The rules haven't applied to them so far. In football especially, this is potentiated in a lot of ways, not least being that it's a culture of violence. Now, it's kabuki violence, it's controlled violence, and football players understand rationally that it is legal and indeed a mandatory part of your job description to clobber the hell out of people on the field, but step outside off the field, and it's a crime you've committed. But you know what they know rationally and what they're able to control in those moments can be two different things.
By the way, this book includes one of the greatest sentences I ever think that I think was ever written in nonfiction. Science will never want to study Charlie Sheen's brain. Congratulations on writing those words.
Thank you, also, I
do have to. I think when you look at this as an overall issue, it is interesting that as we, I think we often think that we've come into that we're more self-involved and there's more interest in ourselves and in this Facebook of this Facebook culture of telling everybody what we're doing. But you pointed that that's different. And really, the numbers don't change on this, do they? Radically,
they don't. I look at Facebook and Twitter off the hook a little bit here because we already saw these narcissism numbers going up significantly from 1979 to 2004, and 2004 is relevant because I believe it was the very first year Facebook existed, just on the Harvard campus. And narcissism rates had already gone up about 30% at that point, due mostly, I think, to the self-esteem movement, which was a very important movement, but also has had some unintended consequences, and sort of grade inflation and the everybody gets a medal ethos at the track meet.
Right.
I think of Facebook and Twitter sort of as, you know, they are to the narcissist what an open bar is to the drunk. It's just an easier, cheaper way to get the substance you were abusing anyway. So, you know, you're going to get drunk faster, but you were getting there anyway.
Jeffrey Kluger, you're one of my favorites. The new book is The Narcissist Next Door. It is published by Riverhead. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a delight.
Thank you very much. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.